Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. And you know, I have a lot of fun on Garden Talk virtually every week on Friday. And one of the most fun programs that I do for Garden Talk, maybe the most fun, is my trip to Bayfield, Wisconsin, to kick off Bayfield in Bloom. And we are broadcasting today from the Bayfield Pavilion right on the shores of Lake Superior. We have a wonderful crowd. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Yeah, you can clap. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. So we have a great crowd to visit and watch the show and to ask some questions. They can certainly ask questions, and you'll be able to ask questions, too, as you listen in today. We have three guests for you. Art Odie is former chair of Bayfield and Bloom. He's a horticultural landscaper, expert on botanical gardens and arboretums. Art Odie, thank you for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here, Larry, again. Thank you.
Yeah, these guys have been around. They've been with us a few times here. Don Kissinger. Don is another one of our guests. He's the WASAW, the West Central Regional Urban Forestry Coordinator for the Department of Natural Resources. And Don's been on the show in the past, and he and I have had some dealings through tree board work across the state. Don, great to have you with us as well.
Thank you, Larry.
And Jason Fishbach, the Ashland-Bayfield Extension Ag Agent, with us today as well. Jason, thank you so much for being with us, too.
Sure, my pleasure. Welcome to Bayfield.
So as we look around, I didn't see the daffodils have come and gone a little bit. There are still a few daffodils out there, Art Odie, but...
Well, there are a few. We had a great daffodil season. Actually, they were in bloom the better part of a month, and they're just over now. But we've got...
Other things coming on.
Oh, yes. The flowering crabs are in bloom now, and the service berries out in the woods and on the streets, and mountain ash will be blooming anytime. This is a great season in Bayfield.
And, you know, Bayfield in bloom is sort of a month-long event. You might just talk a little bit about what's going on.
Well, officially, Bayfield in bloom is May 14th through June 13th, and we have a whole host of events starting with this kickoff. Really, Bayfield is in bloom almost all year long. Maybe not January and February, but almost all year long. And we'd like to have all of the listeners out there just go to the chamber website, and it's chamber. Carrie, what's our chamber website? Bayfield.org. Anyway, just go and go to our website for the chamber and get a whole list of events. But one event particularly that I would like to mention is the garden tours, which will be on Saturday, June 5th. Bayfield has a lot of very fine private gardens. I couldn't begin to start telling you how many there are and who they are and where they are, but we will have an annual garden tour this year, so please come and see our beautiful gardens.
So bayfield.org, that's the place
yes.
to go. All right. Don Kissinger, great to have you back with us. Let's get emerald ash borer out of the way here. We haven't seen any in this part of the state yet.
Correct. Yet is a operative word, I guess. But as I had mentioned, Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection is trapping, putting out about 9,000 traps throughout the state. And our friends to the north and east of us in the Upper Peninsula do have emerald ash borer. So it is something that could show up at any time.
Well, we'll hope it stays away for a while, but it's probably going to be here eventually. And Jason Fishbach, we can go to something a little more fun to talk about than emerald ash borer. You're involved in some cool research. You've got some trials going on fruit crops and also hazelnuts, which I find really interesting.
Yeah, it's an exciting time to be in Bayfield right now, especially working with the orchard owners. We've got trials on sweet cherries and red and white currants, black currants, a whole range of different fruit crops. And I think we'll see a whole set of new fruit crops that are available over the coming years based on these trials. Wine grapes we're doing some work with. And hazelnuts, we just established this spring a research planting here in Bayfield, one of four across the upper Midwest that's looking at our promising hazelnut varieties and see which ones will perform well. And Bayfield makes sense to do it here because in the woods, especially in western Bayfield County, hazelnuts grow everywhere. So we're right in the epicenter of hazelnut.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of hazelnut growing in Canada, so if they can do it there, we ought to be able to do it here.
Definitely hardy here. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll take some questions. Again, if you'd like to join us, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And anyone in the audience with a question, too, raise your hand. And Jim Packard, who is here, will get to you, and we'll take care of your question. But let's go to the phones here for Matt in Waukesha, who has a question. Matt, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. My question is about these little green worms that I get in my fruit trees, my apple trees, every year. They're small, and they got like a silk that comes out the back of them, and they make a big web. And they seem to destroy the apples. You can't tell until the apples get bigger. But is there a way to control them or eliminate them without using chemicals?
Non-chemical. Jason, we'll turn to you first. Jason Fishbach.
This is the season of the lepidopteran. All the caterpillars come out about this time of year in our apple trees, and most of them are really not causing much of a problem. We have leaf rollers. Sounds like you probably have green fruit worm. And they chew on the leaves. They will chew on the fruit a little bit. The main concern we have about those are in younger trees, if they feed on the growing points, because it can deform the tree. In our older trees, they're going to cause some damage. If with your trees, are you seeing, you know, you're losing 90% of your fruit, or are you just seeing an apple here, an apple there, or just seeing some leaf damage?
I don't lose the fruit, but the fruit becomes incredibly deformed by the time it's mature. I heard them referred to as webworms before.
Yep. If it's a small enough scale, it's not, you know, unrealistic to go and hand pick them out, especially if they're going to their webs. They'll go there at night, and so if you get out there first thing in the morning and the evening, you just go in there and close your eyes and squish the mess of them.
All right.
Other than that, there are organically approved chemicals that will work pretty well. BT can work on these lepidopterans if you've given up on the hand.
Yeah. You need direct contact with that, though?
Definitely. They have to actually eat it.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Matt. Don in Boaz, you are next. Hi, Don. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have two questions for your guest.
Okay.
First one is regarding seeding for logging trails. We've got 80 acres of woods here, and a fellow is going through and reopened those old trails, remnants of them, with a dozer. And I want your advice as to what kind of seed mix to put in as soon as the dozing is done. Secondly, blackberries. I know that blackberries are kind of iffy in this part of the country. Do you think if I buy blackberry bushes from Young's and plant them here according to the map, I can get away with that and get some blackberries? Those are the questions.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling. Don, you want to start? Don Kissinger?
Well, I'll grab the first one, and I'll actually kind of defer it to whatever field forester is in your county. That's who I would talk to regarding reseeding your logging trail, because depending on where you are in the state, different types of grasses you might want to be planting. So I would defer to your forester. Go to the DNR website and find out who that forester is, and they should be able to help you with what seeding and when that seeding should occur.
Okay, so go to the DNR website and then click your county and
there's a field
type in your county, I think.
Yeah, there's field foresters in all counties throughout the state, and they're the ones who can help you with what varieties you should use and when you should be seeding and how to do the site prep also.
If I can jump in on that too, there's a decision that landowners have to make, because if you can buy grass seed mixes that are intended for stabilization, so they grow very quickly and help secure the site from erosion. So if you've got steep slopes, that's probably what you'll be steered to, for good reason. The other option is a native mix of seed that's native to that particular site, and they can be slower to establish and not as quick to grow, so it might be a mix. But just keep that in mind when you're talking with your foresters.
Okay, what about this blackberry situation? Anybody have an idea on that one? Jason, you have an idea on that?
So these species of fruit crops that are a bit iffy because of winter injury or something else, my philosophy on it is give it a shot. Why not, right? In some years, you might get a fruit crop. In other years, you might lose the whole plant. Now, you know, I wouldn't put in 50 acres of blackberries, but you could definitely try a few here and there.
Why not?
You can provide some winter protection for it, too. to try to help keep those cans through the winter. The other option, and often folks confuse true blackberries with black raspberries. Black raspberries are pretty bomb-proof. They do have nice thorns on them, but they, you know, taste fairly similar to me. They're not quite like those big, huge thumb-size blackberries, but the black raspberries do really well.
All right.
There are all sorts of native blackberries or black raspberries that I suppose you might go out and actually pick some and seed them from the fruit yourself if you're not really interested in having a quick crop.
Yeah. Why not? Thank you very much for calling. Good luck to you, Don. Appreciate it. Dan in Partyville, let's go to you now. Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question about Concord grapes. I have a big stand of them. They're very old. I don't trim them. But this year, because of the warm spring, the leaves budded out pretty early. And, of course, you know it got cold. The leaves that did start coming out, they turned brown and shriveled up. Some of them have, like, little spider webs on them. And I need to know if those are spiders. Do I need to spray them, or is that just turning brown from the cold? Do I need to do anything to have those leaves come back?
Okay, Art, you want to take a shot?
Nope, that's Jason's.
Okay. All right. Okay.
I thought you were going to say, nope, don't do anything, but
I'll try.
No, let's go to Jason.
This early spring has been a real challenge for grape growers. You know, we know that it's somewhat marginal, and we got nailed with a very early spring and then some really cold days. We had, you know, weeks of 60s, and then we had nights of 16 degrees, and so grapes do not like that. But the beauty of grapes is that they have three buds within each bud, actually, and the first one will start to grow, and it can get nailed by frost, so it sounds like that's what happened to you. Then there's a second one that will grow, and oftentimes if that one gets nailed by frost, there'll be a third one that will grow at each bud. Now, usually just the first one will produce the grapes, the second one will just be vegetative, and the third one often is only vegetative. But Concord, I'm not sure, it might depend a bit on your region. But my feeling is that the second bud will still be fruitful. So, you know, don't give up on it. Just prune off all that dead stuff. It'll fall off on its own. The webbing, I'm not sure. You know, I'd have to see. It's probably associated with the frost injury, and it might just be the plant breaking down now that it's frozen.
There's a nice little extension publication on growing grapes in Wisconsin as well, and you can get that from the extension, the Learning Store website. Might be useful for you to have as well, because it does talk about pruning grapes too, and it's got some pretty good instructions on how to just really go about doing that. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Larry Mealer here. As we visit with three guests today, Art Odey, who is a former chair of the Bayfield and Bloom Horticulture Landscape, landscaper, Jason Fishbach, Ashland Bayfield County Extension Ag Agent, and Don Kissinger with the Department of Natural Resources. He's the West Central Regional Urban Forestry Coordinator. Again, join us at 1-800-642-1234. We have a great audience here today at the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, to kick off Bayfield in Bloom. Today's the kickoff day. I'm Larry Mealer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad you're listening in here for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mealer with my three guests, Art Odey, Jason Fishbach, and Don Kissinger, and a great audience as we celebrate and kick off Bayfield in Bloom. If you have a gardening question, and you know, here these guys are, we got landscapers, we've got people who are experts in flowers, we've got people who are experts on trees, and people who are experts in, well, Jason, you're an expert on a whole lot of things, actually, when you get right down to it. I'm not even going to start in on his list. Give us a call again at 800-642-1234. And please, from the audience, if you have a question, Jim Packard is just dying to get out there with that microphone and take your question. So just raise your hand if you have a question for us. And we have an email from Bonnie. Last summer she planted some bee balm. The way it's spread so far, I was wondering if I should have passed that plant on for something else. It's four times larger than I wanted and spreading fast. This is the attack of the bee balm. Is there a way to encircle it to keep it from taking over Bailey's Harbor.
Well, I'll take a stab
Art
at that
Odie,
one.
Go ahead.
Now's the time for you to join your local garden club so that you can share some of that wonderful bee balm with other people. Just keep hacking it back and passing it on to others with a little cautionary tale.
Doesn't sound like she wants to do it that way, though, Art. I don't know. What do you think, Jason?
Well, you know, some of these species that will spread like that, one option is to actually grow it in a pot and then bury the pot, and so then it can't creep out of it. So this is done with oregano, which can take over a garden pretty quickly. Same thing. This might be an option. You dig it out, plant it in a pot. The pot might stick out of the ground a couple of inches, and then it'll stay within that thing. And by burying the pot, you don't have to water it as often because it's insulated by the soil. So you could try that. Otherwise, you're just, like Art said, you just have to keep beating it back, basically.
All right. Well, we can take some more emails as well. The email address, talk@wpr.org, or again, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And there's a question. We're here at the center here where we're broadcasting from. There are some great booths and exhibits up, and there's one from the Apostle Island bookstore, and I tell you what, Apostle Island Booksellers, I think, is the name of their store, and there's a book there I was looking at, and it had to do with plants that you can grow that deer don't like, and I immediately wanted to get a copy of that book. And maybe we'll get that person scheduled for our show. The person's the author's from New York, but, you know, sort of the same latitude. And they have their share of deer, too. But I'm wondering, Art, as a landscape guy, are there some plants out there that you like that the deer don't like?
Well, they don't like daffodils. And that's why we plant daffodils. They do like tulips, so the tulips stay near the house where the... Where the dog can keep the deer away. In my experience, it's not so much a matter of what the deer won't eat. It's a matter of how hungry are the deer. And there are a lot of deer-proof plants, so to speak. But, boy, deer get hungry, and they'll eat almost anything. I don't know. Maybe Jason can add to that.
Well, one strategy I teach the master gardeners is there's a difference between formal and informal gardening. And a formal would be kind of spaced plants, and you're going to notice if that plant gets chewed on by a deer. If you have informal plantings, like rain gardens might look like, or, you know, more like a perennial garden, kind of a native prairie, the deer browse on it, and you don't notice because there's other stuff kind of there to take its place. So that's one option, is you just kind of trick the deer, and you don't care if they do a little browsing because it's not intended to be a formal garden.
And Don, what about trees and shrubs?
Well, I think some of the trees that do get hammered are balsam fir. They like those. They will hit the white pine. Red pine they don't like. I think there are shrubs that they will not hit. I think dogwood might be one that they are not as fond of, but... I'm not real well versed in that.
Well, I tell you what, there are very few things they won't, yep. They won't chomp on. I'm pretty sure of that. If they're hungry enough, they'll eat anything. Linda in Eau Claire, let's go to you now. Hi, Linda. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a couple of red twigged dogwood bushes that I trimmed back last year. And because they weren't doing so well. And now this year they've come back, what, with just green foliage at the very top. So the bottoms are real woody and leggy. And I'm wondering if I should cut them back again or what I should do.
I can take that one. How large are these shrubs?
About 4 feet.
Well, as dogwood or any other real aggressively growing shrub gets larger, you want to always cut out about a third of the oldest canes, and that will keep your shrub, not only in scale, but it will, you will have younger twigs, which in the case of the red dogwood will have much better color. So trim them back when you do. Trim them all the way back to the base of the plant and always take out the oldest stems and maybe a third of the plant. And that'll keep it all in scale and keep it young and healthy.
Mm-hmm. So is it too late to do that now? Can I cut off all that new growth that's on top?
Well, you're talking about actually decreasing the height of the shrub, I take it.
Correct.
Is that what you're doing?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you can do that. It isn't going to hurt the plant, but when you do just trim back a shrub like that from the top without taking out the largest canes, what you end up doing is turning it into a basketball shape or something else that isn't very natural looking. So be careful about just going around and snipping off the tops of things, because you'll end up looking like you've got something else than a natural shrub.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Let's go to Sarah and Hazel Green. Sarah, hello to you.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I believe I have squash beetles in our garden, and I'm guessing they've been there for like 2, maybe 3 years. My 5-year-old really wants to plant pumpkins. Is there anything I can spray them with to kill them?
What do these squash beetles look like?
They're kind of a triangle shape, I think, and kind of brown.
Okay, do you see a bunch of different...
I'm guessing that's what they are, because I looked it up on the internet last year when I found them.
Okay. If it's the you know, the squash bug, so you're going to see the whole different sizes, all the larvae that are different as they molt and get bigger. So some are brown, some are kind of a iridescent green or a light gray, different colors. The best way to take care of those, if you don't want to use chemicals, is you early scouting and often, and you look on the undersides of the leaves, and you'll look for egg masses. That's where they lay them, and then you just squish them with your thumb. You just have to keep at it. You know, every couple of days, be out there looking for it. And if you get that first generation, you shouldn't have to worry about it the rest of the season. So it's kind of gruesome and gross, but that's what we do a lot in our garden.
Kids would like it, though. Kids would have. You know how to do it. Sick the kids on them. Thanks, Sarah. Thanks a lot for calling. Matt in Green Bay. We go to you now. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I was wondering about black currants. If it's easy to find around here, if it's possible to plant them around here or grow them around here?
Black currants in the Green Bay area.
Yeah. Yeah, black currants will do extremely well. They have a real nice a wide range where they'll grow on sand and clay. A couple of varieties that have been trialed up here in Bayfield, Titania is probably the easiest to find, and then there's the Ben series. So Ben Sarek is fairly common. There are quite a few currants. Black currants are grown in all over Europe, so there are Scottish varieties that are available. Ben Sarek and Titania are going to be the ones most common, and they do fine. It's just a matter of what do you do with the currants once you grow them.
All right. Well, we have some folks in the audience who may have questions. So let's take a question from the audience. And your name?
My name is Fran.
Hold on a second. We're not sure that we're hearing. Let's see. While we take care of the microphone situation here, we'll take another call. Let's go to Mary in Fitchburg. Mary, hi.
I have a question about Creeping Charlie.
Right.
We have a lot of it. We need to get rid of it, and we have little kids, so we don't want to use anything that isn't safe. Can you help me figure out the best way to take care of that?
I have spent many hours on my lawn with my 6-year-old. She was 5 last year, and we go out there and in the grass and pull Creeping Charlie. Now, we can clear it out. It always comes right back.
Great.
But it's fun to do, and I've had some of my best conversations with my daughter, Emily, I've had while we were right next to each other on the lawn picking Creeping Charlie. But
okay.
there has to be probably a more efficient way.
Now, Larry, when I listen to the show and all the experts come on, and I just think how much you know having listened to all these experts, that maybe this one, let's turn the tables and let's turn to our expert, Larry Mueller, who's probably taken this question how many times? Larry, how do we take care of Creeping Charlie organically?
I honestly don't know how to do it organically, other than you can try to kill the whole area. Yeah, that's one thing you can do. You can pick it. We really actually do have pretty good success out of flower gardens, the flower bed area. Lawns, it's really hard to pick it out. But we work the hand pick and pull, and you're not going to get it all. But if you you can knock it back in our flower gardens. We can knock that back for the whole year if we're pretty good early in the season, just getting down on the hands and knees and pulling it. Now, other people may not have had that good success, but we've had good results that way. I do not know of a way, another way, other than killing off a whole area by covering it. Art, maybe you've got an idea.
I'm going to tickle Jason here a little bit and ask him whether he's had any experience with corn gluten with Creeping Charlie.
Yeah, so corn gluten acts, or sold as Preen often and some other brand names, it acts as a pre-emergent herbicide, so it prevents the weeds from starting to grow. So it could potentially prevent the Creeping Charlie from growing from seed. The problem is once you've got Creeping Charlie, the corn gluten meal won't do anything once it's already there.
That's the problem. So and picking it out, as you probably well know, Mary, if you've tried to pick it out of your own lawn, it's almost a losing proposition. And I've told this story before. I got so mad at all the Creeping Charlie about 8 years ago, I killed my whole lawn. Killed the whole lawn, repaired the seed bed. I had a horticulturist friend came and said, this is the best looking seed bed I've ever seen. Planted some grass seed, started all over again, and now I probably have more Creeping Charlie per square foot than anybody, almost anybody in the neighborhood. It just keeps coming back. And the neighbors on both sides have it, so their lawns look like purple landscapes. So once you have neighbors with it, it's pretty hard to keep it out. So my advice, take the kids out there, hand pick, have some fun with them. And if you don't, especially since you don't want to use chemicals, there are some chemicals that can knock it down.
And I think, you know, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. If your neighbors aren't taking care of it, you can do the greatest job in the world, and it's going to come back year in and year out.
Yeah, I had a great-looking lawn the next year after I killed him. But after that, the Creeping Charlie was right back in there.
Well, the old advice that you hear over and over again, and I'll just repeat it, is that if you keep your lawn really well fertilized, well watered, and mowed high, you'll have much less in the way of weeds, and that probably includes Creeping Charlie, at least to an extent.
Yeah, although I do all those things, and I still have it. Well, thank you, Mary. I'm sorry we didn't have more positive information for you, but there you have it. Let's go back to our audience now, and let's see who do we have here.
Fran from Bayfield.
Oh, Fran from Bayfield. Okay.
Right. And last year I planted several small hemlocks. And they look a little sad. I was wondering, should I be fertilizing them or should I just let them alone?
You planted them last year?
Yes.
Last fall or?
I planted a couple in the spring and a couple in the fall.
Okay.
Well, I take that one. Rule number one with hemlocks is they really want a moist, partially shaded environment. Naturally, your hemlock seedlings will grow on the north side of a steep slope or a riverbank. So you want them to be moist and shaded. If they're not growing properly, a little bit of fertilizer certainly wouldn't hurt, but maybe you need to be sure that you have them properly mulched so that their roots will stay cool. They really are a tree that wants to be in a moist forest environment. So try and give them some of that, and you'll have good luck. They do grow here just fine.
I asked about the time of year of planting. Just was wondering because there was some dry spells last year, if I'm not mistaken. They need a kind of a moist soil. So,
and they need a soil that's not sandy or has a lot of clay either. So I guess I don't, you know, if you're going to use a fertilizer, use a slow release. I don't like something high in nitrogen because it greens it up, but it doesn't help the roots at all. And it greens it up to the detriment of the roots, to be quite honest. So typically, if you plant them properly, water them properly, mulch them, have them in the correct habitat, typically trees in general don't need much, if any, fertilizer.
Yeah. Well, let's take another question from our audience here in Bayfield.
Hello. I have a gardening question. My four-year-old has started pumpkin seeds indoors, uh-huh. and they're growing like crazy. My understanding, though, is that they're really difficult to transplant. Any ideas on how to make them live? Because he'll be very disappointed if they don't.
And, and they need to be sort of made hardy, too, for the outside. It's something you don't want to be doing is just taking it from the inside to the outside, do you, Jason?
Yeah, that's definitely true for all the cucurbits. If you're going to transplant them, you've really got to baby them the first couple of weeks. So it's I use about a week to harden them off. So the first day they're out for about 2 hours, and you don't ever put them out when the wind's blowing and it's 90 degrees. So out in the sun for 2 hours, bring them back in, 4 hours the next day, 6 hours, 8 hours, if your schedule permits. And gradually harden them off, and you'll probably see some of the older leaves look a little yellowish as they've adjusted, and then you should have vigorous new growth. The main thing is don't transplant them out too early, because if they get in cold temperatures, they'll actually be stunted, and they just never seem to recover. Frost will outright kill it, so just take your time. And the debate still rages whether for the cucurbits you're better off transplanting them or just direct seeding them, and often you'll hear stories that people will do comparisons, and they'll start one inside for 6 weeks and then plant it at the same time they plant a seed, and by the end of the year, they can't tell any difference. And that's a way you can avoid that problem. But for now, yeah, just harden it off and then plant it out. I'd wait till June to stick that out.
Yeah.
You might have to pot it up another time to give it room to continue growing until that time.
Yeah. Good advice there. And we'll take one more from the audience, and we'll go back to the phones.
Yes, I have a delphinium that has come up about 12 inches, and the tips of the leaves are, some of them are a little wrinkled and black, and I wonder if this is a problem or if it was just from the frost.
All right. Jason, you want to take that?
I don't know that much about the delphinium in terms of are there other disease problems. My guess is it's probably some frost injury. We're seeing that on a lot of plants because we've gone from 70 to 16 and even colder, back and forth. And even plants that aren't known to be frost sensitive are showing some symptoms. Sweet peas even are showing some stunting. And a lot of folks are seeing distorted apple leaves, and that's from frost injury. It doesn't outright kill them, but it will distort them. So that's my guess.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. Let's go to Glidden, Wisconsin, next and talk to Tammy on the phone. Tammy, hello.
Hello. Nice and
what
cold
can we do
today.
For you? Great to have you with us.
Thank you. I've got a really good question. Excuse me. I've got these bushes that are in the front of my house, and they attract mosquitoes and spiders. Now, many years ago, I know I had certain bushes that repel mosquitoes, and I can't remember what it's called. It's like a greeny, kind of leafy, thin leaf.
Greeny and leafy. Well, that covers
kind
a lot
of
ground.
I can't remember what it is.
Yeah, Jason says, I think this is a question for Art Odie to answer. I don't know.
I don't know about bushes, but usually anything with, you know, with a real pungent odor would help to keep insects away. But I can't think of anything in my experience that, yeah, at least in northern latitudes, that would actually repel insects. You know, chrysanthemums will repel insects, but they're not a shrub. So I don't know what you might have had, honestly.
Somebody else may have an idea, maybe from the audience or maybe online, because I can't think of anything other than a bat house and some bats that that help help keep the mosquito population down. Actually, we usually use
plenty of birds, swallows particularly.
Yeah, bats are really good. You know, they'll they really go after the mosquitoes at night when they're out flying around. But we can't all have a bad house, I guess. Let's take another. Thank you. I hope we. Well, we did not help you, unfortunately, Tammy. To be perfectly honest, but maybe somebody else can help along the way. We'll see if somebody else has an idea about that particular bush. Stay listening. That's all I got to say. Let's take a question from the audience here.
Hi, Kathy from out by Mason. And I've got a bunch of six-year-old Diablo ninebarks, and they have the nice deep purple-colored leaves. And I've noticed that several of them now, in the last couple of years, have branches that are producing green leaves on them. And I'm wondering if I should just let that be or trim those off or what may be happening with those shrubs.
How shady a location is that?
They're in full sun.
Well, it's not a matter of being in the shade then. I've seen them kind of decline in different situations, but I haven't personally seen any that have reverted to green leaves, although I wouldn't say that that's impossible.
And the leaves themselves look very healthy. They're not distorted at all. They're just a different color.
Would there be a soil issue there?
You might try addition of iron to your soil. What do you think, Jason?
Well, are you seeing that it's an entire shoot from the ground up that's green, or do you see some green and red leaves on the same branch?
It's from the entire shoot up.
Oh.
Okay. Well, that's not that uncommon in plants. There you get what we call sports that are different colors. Wow. And actually, a lot of our apple varieties come from just that. It's more or less a mutation in the buds that sends out a little different kind of plant at that point. So, you know, you might have the next great thing, or just prune it out if you don't like the green.
Yeah. Lop it off, one or the other. Oh, man, we're having some fun today. We are broadcasting from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here with Art Odie, who is a horticulture landscaper, expert in botanical gardens and arboretums. Jason Fishbach, who is our Ashland-Bayfield County Ag Agent. Don Kissinger, Wausau, is the West Central Regional Urban Forestry Coordinator for the Department of Natural Resources. All of those guests here with a great audience on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with three great guests and a great audience at the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin. This is the kickoff day for Bayfield in Bloom, a month-long series of great events that'll be going on, some wonderful garden tours. I can tell you there are some fantastic gardens in this city and in this area, and a lot of activities associated with the flowers and landscapes, and I hope you have a chance to get to this area. Please do so. Good place to go to find out information on Bayfield. Go to bayfield.org, and that's the site that has all of the information about the various events that are going on over the next month. But if you have a question today, it could be about a tree, it could be about your landscape, it could be flowers, it could be the vegetables. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, and we'll take some questions from the audience as well. And as a matter of fact, we have a question right now from the audience, so let's take that now.
Yes, good morning. My name is Diana, and I live here in Bayfield. And I have one question, but I also have a comment about the mosquito bush.
Okay.
Scent a geranium called citronella is actually marketed as a mosquito plant, and it's a tender perennial, so it's not something you can just plant in your yard. I have mine in a pot, and that might help. Any of the scented geraniums are very pungent and can help ward off mosquitoes, so maybe that will help this lady. My question is, when using manure as fertilizer, even well rotted, do we need to be concerned about E. coli splashing onto the vegetable plants?
All right. Well, Jason, we turn to you for that one.
In general, yes, always be careful with manure, whether it's well-rotted or if it's, you know, certainly if it's fresh, because you just don't know, so err on the side of caution. Generally, you would incorporate that in the spring or in the fall and then make sure that it's basically well-worked into the soil. And it, generally, if you're going to put that in, then you'd pick crops that aren't in contact with the soil, so things like tomatoes or peppers. Root crops or leafy greens in particular, because you don't really wash them or cook leafy greens. That's a time where you don't put manure in that year for that crop if you want to be absolutely safe. I don't know the guidelines offhand, but because manure is so important to organic systems, there are clear guidelines in terms of how soon you can plant or harvest after manure has been incorporated in the soil, both rotted and fresh manure. And fresh manure in general is not a good idea.
You wouldn't be putting that on your garden.
It's too hot. Yeah. But even well-rotted, you don't know.
Yeah.
So be careful with it.
All right. Let's take a question from Barrett in Florence next, who's online, I believe. Barrett, are you there?
Yes, I am. I don't have I have a question, but my first part is a comment. On the road going into my cottage, we have wild hazelnuts. And they look just the same as the ones in Finland, on the southern coast of Finland. So I can't tell you what, you know, what strain it is or anything.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah.
Art, you were going to make a comment.
Well, I think you have the native hazelnut there. It would not. It might look exactly like the European hazelnut. Excuse me, hazelnut, but it's not the same species. Tell me if I'm right or wrong, Jason. One of the differences between the European hazelnut and the American hazelnut, from a edibility standpoint and a commercial standpoint, is that the European species. The husk of the nut opens very readily, so that the nut can be harvested very easily, whereas with the American species, the husk opens very, very slowly, so it's hard to harvest the nuts. And that's why hybrids between the European and the American hazelnut are more desirable from an edibility standpoint. Jason?
Yeah, you've got that correct. The breeding in the European hazelnut has resulted in an involucre, is what it's called, or the green fleshy husk around the nut that's, you know, not very big, and so the nuts fall out pretty readily. Versus our wild American, it holds those nuts pretty tightly, and the beaked, which is another species, really holds it. It totally surrounds it. So you've got it right.
All right.
Interesting. The other comment was. I have both black currant and red currant and gooseberry bushes growing up there. So the person who called from Green Bay wondered, he should be fine.
Should be. Shouldn't have any trouble. You know, exactly. Absolutely. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And we'll take another phone call. It's Bob in Mindora. We'll turn to you next. Hi, Bob.
Yep. Hello. See, we're living here about 15 miles northeast of La Crosse, and there's a wild plant that seems to be absolutely invading the ditches and field areas in some places that I've looked into, and it seems to be what's called a cow parsnip. It can grow up to be about head height, and it has almost a blossom that almost resembles like a Queen Anne's lace type blossom. And I've been putting Weed Be Gone on it. I think I've got it controlled, so it hasn't hit our property yet. But if it does, I'm afraid it's going to be just all over. And it seems sometimes to come back the second time I put Weed Be Gone on, like it halfway enjoys it. But I've got it knocked down kind of for the last couple of years. But this year, the Weed Be Gone didn't take it. I've done some work with Roundup, and it seems to be kind of hit and miss whether that takes it out or not. So I went out there, and everything I could find, I actually cut down this spring after I treated it a couple times. And I'm just wondering if you guys know anything about that, or if there's anything more effectively I should be doing.
Well, it's a very aggressive and invasive species, and I think one thing you should be certain to do in addition to what you've already done is to cut the flower heads before they produce seed. The other thing, and I'm not an expert in the parsley family, but there are a lot of poisonous plants in the parsley family, both from an edibility standpoint and also from a dermatological
standpoint. Yeah.
And you got to be very careful with anything that looks like the plant that you're describing. So it might be best for you to contact your extension agent or somebody else who's knowledgeable and can actually key that species out so you know exactly what you're dealing with. I would be careful with anything that looks like the parsley family.
I would not be doing that barehanded with short sleeve shirts. That for sure. You might want to handle that's something to worry about for sure. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your calling. You just have to keep at it, I guess, Jason. You're going to just have to keep knocking it back. Well, and Don, you've probably, I know the Department of Natural Resources has been involved not so much with, some with parsnip, yeah, but more with other invasives.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that invasive, though, there.
Not that particular one, but there are a number of them out there. And I'm just reading a couple of days ago that there are now apparently some super weeds out there that are, that Roundup can't kill. And if that happens, if we have some super weeds, we can have some real issues. And that's not good news at all. And on that happy note, let's go to a question from the audience.
I'm Sylvia from Ashland, and I've been seeing articles on, you know how we're all using rain barrels now, mm-hmm, that there may be some concern about the chemicals in your asphalt shingles and using that rainwater from your rain barrels on your vegetable gardens. Can you give me any ideas about that?
Mm-hmm. Jason.
I can try. So generally, yes, there's going to be some what we'd call leachate out of that asphalt through the water. But with all of these chemicals, the phrase dose makes the poison. And so if you tested that water, likely you're going to find compounds that you probably don't want in there that came out of that asphalt. However, to what concentration, it doesn't matter, right? So then it becomes kind of your own decision about just how much is too much. And so if you're concerned about it, I'm not familiar with the research that's out there that if there is a true legitimate concern at this point. But in some ways, it doesn't matter. If you're concerned about it, then don't use that rainwater. You know, I have heard the ideal would be a slate roof, but that costs many, many dollars. So.
Well, the other thing I'd suggest is if you are concerned about it, and maybe you should be, use the rainwater, the rain barrel water, to water your trees and shrubs rather than on your garden with edible plants.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's turn to Jerry and Superior next. Jerry, hello to you.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thanks for calling.
Hey, I have a couple of questions. Number one, I'm in Superior. We have red clay, of course, here. I have two apple trees in the front of my yard that we got about 5-6 years ago. They bloomed and produced apples the first year we planted them and haven't bloomed since. And how can I fix that? What do I need to do? My second question is has to do with roses. And, again, red clay. I know roses, they're hybrid tea roses, and they need good drainage. So I have a little bit of a raised garden. But what should I mix in with the red clay and to get a good soil for the roses?
Okay, well, we got about a minute or so to answer that, aren't
well,
you?
Well, the first thing I would suggest is that you never mix sand with clay because you'll end up with cement. So if you're going to add anything to your clay soil, be sure that it's organic. And any good organic source will help to break up that clay. And you had another question tonight.
The other question.
Yeah, about the apples. So Larry says here we're short on time, so let me give you a short answer. Number one is time. Sometimes the tree just needs to mature to produce flowers. The other one is you want to make sure your branches are growing horizontally, not vertically. Vertical branches are not going to flower because they're trying to grow tall. And if they're so you've got to span them out or somehow tie them down to get them to trained out horizontally. The other one is you just have to be careful with any sort of fertility that you're not adding any nitrogen because that can favor vegetative growth over flowering. And then the last one, which I've forgotten.
Oh, there's another way to do it. You can kind of score the tree a little bit too.
Yeah, so that's another one. If you can just ring the tree around it, just real like on a branch, not the trunk, just real lightly you score, and that stresses the tree, moves with the chemicals in the tree, the plant hormones, and it tricks it into flowering.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. On this edition of Garden Talk from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, visiting with Art Odie, Jason Fishbach, and Don Kissinger here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're having another great time with Garden Talk. Today, broadcasting from Bayfield, Wisconsin. The Bayfield Pavilion, as a matter of fact, right on the shore of Lake Superior. I have three guests with me today, Extension Agent Jason Fishbach, DNR Forester Don Kissinger, and Landscape Expert Art Odie Jr. And of course, when the four of us get together, especially the three of them, the talk always turns to landscaping, it turns to gardening, it turns to those trees that you might have planted outside, and your landscape in general. They know a lot. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. We'll be back with our guests right after this look at the news. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here broadcasting to kick off Bayfield in Bloom from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin. I'm looking out the windows. Now, it's a beautiful pavilion, by the way. Looking out the windows now at Lake Superior. There's a few clouds in the sky. Kind of a beautiful day to be on Lake Superior and in the town of Bayfield. And this whole area of the state is a wonderful area. Go online to Bayfield and Bloom, or I should say, go online to bayfield.org, bayfield.org, and take a look at all of the events that are happening over the next month in this area. Lots of things relating to the garden. And, of course, this is Garden Talk, so what better to have kick off Bayfield and Bloom but doing our show from here. And our guest today, Art Odie. Art is an expert in botanical gardens and arboretums, a horticulture landscaper. Jason Fishbach is our Ashland Bayfield County Ag Agent. Don Kissinger is the West Central Region Urban Forestry Coordinator with the Department of Natural Resources and knows obviously a whole lot about trees. So glad to have them here, and thank you for listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234. And, of course, a great audience here today. And anyone in the audience has questions, I hope you will raise your hand. And gentleman Jim Packard will be there with the microphone to get your question. And we have virtually every line full, as a matter of fact. Let's go to Roland in Wausau. Roland, go ahead. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a baby twisty locust that hasn't got any buds or leafed out so far this year. It was beautiful last year. Am I just impatient, or do I have a dead tree?
You said you have a black locust that's not,
a baby
or a honey locust that's not leafing out right now.
Yeah.
I live in the Wausau area too, and I'm seeing locusts that are just starting to leaf out now. So I guess I wouldn't be too concerned unless you do have some limbs that actually have leaves on them and other ones that do not. Is that the case?
No. There's just nothing there, and I know that. The last couple of years, it's 3 years old, or 3 years since I bare root planted it. It's always late to leaf out, maybe, and we had an early spring, and maybe I'm just impatient. And I have a comment, though. I live on the river. I have a bat house near the river. I have a frog pond near my deck. and also have toad houses in the garden area, and virtually no problems with mosquitoes.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
Earlier.
You hit all three of the natural, the best natural fighters for mosquitoes. That's for sure. That's great. Unfortunately, we still have mosquitoes on our lawn. You know, we use on our patio. Sometimes when they're at their worst, we use a fan. Turn the fan on. There, mosquitoes are notoriously bad flyers, and they can't take wind. And so we just turn the fan on at the low or even medium sometimes, and we can sit out there with no mosquito repellent on and do just fine with a fan. Thank you very much for calling. Amy in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. When I brought my dinner plate dahlias up from the basement, which I cover with burlap, they had about a foot of growth of white stalk, very leggy and loose. And so I brought them up now, and now they're getting the typical green at the ends of this long white stalk. And I'm just wondering what I'm going to do. How should I support them, or what should I do?
Well, if you set them out, I would try and keep them shaded until they really green up. Just shade them a little bit so that they don't get sunburned and windburned with a very tender growth.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. There you have it. Thanks, Amy.
Do you think that the white part will continue to live for the season?
If it's not too far along, they should develop chlorophyll as soon as they get outside and get some natural sunlight, but don't expose them too much.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And let's go to Brian in Milwaukee. Hi, Brian.
Hi there. I have a question for you. I have 6 mock orange shrubs that I planted. This will be the 4th summer that they've been in the ground, and they never seem to grow. They have new growth of 6 inches to a foot, and then all of the leaves tend to start browning on the edge, and then a week later, the entire leaf is brown and dead, and that's the continuing cycle I've been having ever since they've been planted. And I have used other treatments from lawn centers and garden centers, and nothing seems to prevent this from happening. It never completely kills the shrub, but all of the new growth continues to die back. And I did send a soil sample to the UW system, and nothing abnormal showed up except for a low nitrogen. And that's all I got.
So you've got a lawn service?
No lawn service. I fertilize on my own with a drop spreader.
Okay, so you're fertilizing. You're not applying herbicides with chemical?
No.
Okay.
The only thing I can say is that mock orange can be rather, I guess the term I'd use is unthrifty.
Yeah.
So maybe you've got some natural dieback there. What's your soil like?
It's lightly clay, about 4 feet down, and then it's fresh topsoil that's about 8 years old, actually. The entire yard was recreated with new soil.
Well, that shouldn't be the problem then. Jason, do you think maybe there's a fungus problem there that those leaves are damping off? Maybe treat it with a fungicide, Captan, or a sulfur-based product?
Potentially. I don't know the specific diseases of mock orange. Now, the fact that the soil test disease analysis came back negative, you know, suggests it's probably not something like that. One thing to think about when we see this with planted shrubs often is that the root wads either were fairly compact when they were planted, or especially in clay, and so they can grow in that space that you dug out, but they can't get any further, the root systems, and so the plants are always kind of sluggish. Now, that wouldn't explain necessarily why it's growing and dying. It would just explain some real slow death, basically, is what it would be. It's a
a slow death. You know, I was sort of going, and thanks a lot for calling, Brian. I wish we could be more help there. I was watching a television show that had to do with a company was coming in and in 2 days we're landscaping, And they planted, as I was watching them plant trees, I'm looking at the way they're planting the trees where they've got a hole, not the typical kind of dish type hole that we're thinking about with when we plant trees. And they were burlap, they were bald and burlapped, and those trees went right down into the ground without the burlap coming off. And I thought to myself, well, now there's some trees that in about 5 years or so are going to be root strangled.
Well, you know, Larry, the burlap itself should rot, but if it's treated burlap so that it doesn't rot, well, then you're going to have an impediment to the roots there.
Yeah, you sure are.
So if Don? The burlap is no. green, you better be sure you take it off.
Yeah. Don, any thoughts on that?
I guess I'd... And Art's correct, the burlap is going to rot away, but I guess I don't like to have any burlap. And what I do when I'm planting trees, I take off the top half along with the wire basket and obviously the twine that's around the trunk. My concern with the burlap is when you're watering lots of times, that burlap sometimes wicks the water away from the root system. So that's why I like to have the top half of the burlap gone. But definitely if you have wire baskets, at least the top half needs to be removed because I've seen trees 10, 15 years later where they've been girdled by the wire that is still remaining there, even though we say it will biodegrade and maybe in 40, 50, 60 years. But that's bad. And lots of times with the twine, that's something that's a poly type thing, so oil-based, and that is going to, if it ever does biodegrade, it's going to take a long time, and that will girdle the tree. And as you said, 5, 6, 7 years down the road, all of a sudden the tree can just tip over, and that's many times the reason why.
Yeah. Brian, thanks again. Ann in, where was Ann from? Brownsville, I believe. Hi, Ann. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is about organic gardening. I would like to start an organic garden, but I don't want to mix my soil, obviously, and I want to put the dirt in planters. And I can't find anyone that knows how to do that correctly and where to get the organic dirt. I've been online, and they've all been dead ends. Is there a website I can go to get help?
Hmm. Where are you at, Brownsville?
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that, Art Odie?
I've never heard of anybody selling organic soil. I guess my take on this is that all soil, if it's not treated with chemicals, I would think you could classify as organic. So I'd be sure that if you're getting topsoil and you want, really want to be organic right from the get-go, that you try and get some good fresh topsoil that hasn't been farmed, that hasn't been used in any other way. And that would be a matter of looking around for it. But I think also if you really want to be sure you're organic, you're going to want to do a soil test. For heavy metals, at least, and then you know that you're starting out right. But I've never heard of anybody actually selling organic topsoil. Now, unless you go to a really good composting where you know that you've got a well composted product without any heavy metals in it.
Yeah, Jason, anything?
Yeah, I was just going to say that you know nor have I heard of organic. Or certified organic topsoil. However, you could get it from a certified organic field or farm, and that certification will guarantee that there hasn't been synthetic pesticides or fertilizers applied within 3 years. And that's about the best you could do, or you just trust where you're getting that topsoil source that they haven't treated it with anything. And you can test for the heavy metals, lead, arsenic, and see if they're above background levels if you're concerned about that as well.
And those tests aren't too expensive. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Where do you get the testing done? Where would I even go to get that done?
There are soils and plant analysis labs pretty much throughout Wisconsin. The university has a soil and plant analysis lab in Madison. Another one.
In Marshfield.
Marshfield is the other one. And you can send to those. Actually, if you go online to the UW Soil and Plant Analysis Laboratory, they'll give you information right on the website as to how to take the samples.
Okay,
and then
great.
And then you need to tell them what you want tested for and what your plans are maybe for the soil.
Okay.
Okay, thanks very for, good. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ann, for calling. Let's take a question from the audience.
Some red and black currants in my backyard garden, but we have a huge and beautiful old white pine tree nearby. Is there a problem there if I would do that? I'm thinking of the white pine blister.
Blister rust, yeah.
Right. That is the alternate host. So, yeah, that definitely is going to be a concern. And basically you're going to have one or the other that's going to grow well. Because with the current, you know, that will move the white pine blister rut spores or allow that to occur in openings in the white pine trees, and over time the tree is going to succumb to that.
The nurseries do sell red currants and the pink champagne or other current cultivars, and they state specifically if they're resistant to white pine blister rust, and so they won't serve as an alternate host in that case. So just make sure that that's the varieties you're buying are resistant.
If they're resistant, does that mean they never ever get involved with it, or do
no.
they just
not necessarily? But they're resistant, right, Jason?
Yeah, they should be, unless there's changes in the actual pathogen. But in general, if it's resistant, it's got the genetic makeup that it won't host an infection.
I have a further question in that regard for either Don or Jason. As I recall, and I don't know if I'm correct, in order not to have the disease spread from one host to another, the currents should be, what, a quarter mile away? Is that there is a distance.
I don't know the distance, but you are correct. There is a distance.
Yeah, man. I'm pretty sure you're not going to be able to plant a quarter mile away from, unless you got a really big lawn.
I know Howard, and he has a tremendous estate.
All right. Oh, man. You know, back to mosquitoes for a minute. Someone emailed in and said, also recommended citronella grass as well as catnip, rosemary, marigolds, and mosquito plants found through the internet or by mail order for mosquito control. And I think if you went online and I'm not going to vouch for the whether these mosquito plants are going to work. But
Well, Larry, the question was specifically shrubs.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so we knew all of these other plants.
Ah, boy. Here's another one. Lou in Montreal emailed in and said, you can order the mosquito plant from Miles Kimball's catalog. So there you have it. Another one. Let's go to Shay in Green Bay next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you. We took down a garage, and of course there was a concrete slab, and under the slab a lot of sand. Is there any hope for preparing that area to be a garden?
So you have a sand area, is what you're telling
us. Yeah, and well, there was a concrete slab there that we broke up, you know, and hauled off, so there's probably a lot of concrete dust.
Did you dig down at all in the sand? Because it's possible that they probably laid sand down before they put and maybe underneath the sand. There might be just a layer of sand.
I would imagine there is. The rest of the yard isn't sandy. The sand was laid down, but I don't know if I have to haul all that sand out of there or if I could mix it with some good topsoil. There's kind of a depression there that's left from the concrete slab being taken out. So I don't know if I can just fill that depression and I'll be all right, or if that area's, if the sand needs to be taken out, if the area's been tainted by the concrete that was taken out.
Well, there's a couple of factors here that you have to think about. One is that concrete has lime in it, and you can end up with a very deficient a soil that's very deficient in iron if there's lime in it. I've seen big trees that failed for no reason whatsoever, except that when you really dug around and looked into the situation, they were planted on top of an old pile of bricks or something. So you have a potential problem there. Although here again, I don't know if you could get a soil test that would tell you whether. Well, here's what I would do: get your sand tested to see what the pH is, and if the pH isn't terrifically high, I would think you could go ahead and use some good organic matter and beef up that sand, and it would probably be okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or you dig down and find out how many. You probably have 2 inches, 3 inches of sand there, maybe something like that. Hard to say, but my guess would be at least 2 inches.
To keep in mind here is compaction. So when they built that, they probably compacted that soil. Yeah. So you're going to have to dig down, and you can poke around with a piece of rebar, or if you can get a soil probe and just see what that soil is like underneath the sand, because that compaction could be a bigger problem than the pH.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you for calling. Appreciate the call. Fred in Menominee Falls, let's go to you. Hi, Fred.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello. What can we do for you?
I have a rather large black walnut tree in my backyard, and I noticed this spring a series of holes. They seem to or appear to be oval through the bark. I'd say easily 30 or 40 of them on the east side of the tree. Is this something I should be concerned about, a bug infestation? I don't see anything wrong with the leaves at the present time.
Are they in a straight line, up and down?
Horizontally. And they actually appear to be rings, I'll say 4 or 5 inches apart from one another. And they do go around the tree, but not 100% around the tree, not a full ring.
I think it's some sapsucker, woodpecker, something of that nature. If it's, are they pretty, the holes, are they pretty symmetrical?
Yes, in somewhat of an oval shape, elongated horizontally.
And how big are these holes, would you say, across? What's the diameter?
I guess across.
Quarter or
width-wise,
nine?
Yeah, I'll say about a quarter and slightly less in height, obviously, because it's an oval.
That's a weird, it's not the way sapsuckers usually. Yeah.
Well, you might have a woodpecker actually looking for grubs beneath the bark there, too. It doesn't sound like a borer.
No.
It sounds like a bird. Sounds like a woodpecker to me.
Hmm. And I guess with that, if you do have a woodpecker, using a wire hardware cloth is what you want to do, put around that to keep that from coming back to that area, and hopefully it doesn't move up or down the tree and start a new area.
Yeah, that can be the problem, but temporarily putting that up, maybe the bird will find another tree on your neighbor's property and move on there. That's always the hope. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I really have had a great time once again with a great audience here and some great guests. I wanted to thank some of the people, Rudy Listing and Paul Guello, who have been engineering for us today. John Munson, of course, our regional director. Rachel Owens has been on the phones today. And Brittany DiArda has been on the board operator. Jim Packard wandering around with a microphone, helping us out here today as well. And then a great audience. Thank you all for coming today to be with us to kick off Bayfield in bloom. It's been a lot of fun. And I just remind you again to, if you want to know what activities are going on in Bayfield, just go to bayfield.org, and you're going to find out about the great tours of the gardens up here, which are a sight to behold. And you're going to have a lot of fun in this part of the state. I always do. And Jim Packard and I look forward to driving up here every single year. It's about 6 hours from Madison. If you follow the miles per hour signs, you will get here in 6 hours. If you don't, maybe a little less. But I did notice several radar setups along the way, so I was glad to survive that. Thank you all for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure having you with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us.